In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about the benefits of using text versus video, how to find a mastermind group, how to start running joint ventures, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 374. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. So where this week, sir?
Not much. Just, the end of the year has come and gone, and it's the first week of the new year. So I've been spending a lot of time lately working on a website redesign for Bluetick, which is about halfway done. So nothing's live yet, but I've been working through website design itself and the email copy for like the automation emails that are being sent out, and then also on the website copy. So coming along pretty well. The next week or so is going to be involved with finalizing all that stuff and then implementing it on the website. So once that's all done, I'm going to start doing a much bigger marketing push, I think.
That's cool. And so you're gearing up for this because you're live and you're trying to drive more traffic. You want more of it to convert. Is that what you're focusing on the site right now?
Yeah. So the main focus on the site right now is because if you come to the site and you've never seen the product before, what I've heard from people is that it does not give them like a good feeling of trust, like, oh, this is a legit company, which I totally get. I mean, you go to the site, there's not a whole lot there and there's not detail. It doesn't even really, give you the inclination that you should reach out and contact the company or sign up for a trial account or something like that, just because you go to a competitor's website and there's tons of information there. There's articles and, testimonials and things like that. And it just looks a lot more professional versus the Bluetick website, which to date I've relied more on word of mouth and people coming in through after hearing me on a podcast or something like that. So it's just not conducive to more of a hands-off sales funnel, I'll say.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, it does feel when I come to the site, bluetick.io for listeners out there who haven't been there, it feels like a WordPress theme or like a Bootstrap, kind of a basic template. And as you said, I think you have good content here, but it's like you said, you don't have the articles and the blog and all this other stuff that other companies that have been around longer might have. So it does seem like just a smaller operation.
Yeah, it's not real specific about exactly what it does or how it works for them. And it doesn't answer really any objections. It doesn't really tell a story or craft one that will resonate with whoever's reading it. So there's a lot of things that, need to go on to the site right now that are just not there. And I've known for a long time that stuff needs to go there. I just haven't sat down and focused on that stuff because I really haven't had time yet.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of priority, right? It's like you were trying to get the code written and then you're trying to get the bugs fixed and then you're trying to scale and then you try to get people onboarded. You got to email the list. You got to write this email. And it just, at a certain point, this is where I still struggle quite a bit with unsolicited advice. Like people used to email and be like, hey, the Drip website, it would be so much better if you did this. And it's like, I know of all people, I think about this all the time, like 20 hours a day. Yes, even when I'm sleeping. So your unsolicited advice is actually not helpful. It makes you feel like you're smart, but people would send screenshots and say, you should change this. Or have you thought about organizing? And it's like, yes, we have. We thought about that. And either we didn't do it very deliberately. We had a good reason for not doing it that you don't understand because you don't work in the business, 50 hours a week. Or we have thought of it. We just haven't had time. We haven't prioritized it yet. And there are more important things. And so that's where I could understand, where the marketing site has maybe fallen to the second or third place on your list.
Oh, it's not. It wasn't even second or third. It was like eighth or 10th or something like that. I mean, my list of things to do is 10 miles long. It's not even a mile long. It's 10 miles long at this point. It's just going back through and trying to figure out, okay, what should I really be working on next? And at this point, it's the website. So once that stuff's in place and once more the marketing emails are in place and do a better job of explaining what the product does and kind of move people through that educational side of things, then I think they'll be in a much better position. So how about you?
Well, last week, as I mentioned, I was in Florida, which was great. It was nice to get away. There was obviously the polar vortex came through Minneapolis, and there were days where the highs were in the negatives, like -3, -4, and the feels like was -25 or -30 at one point. So it's, pretty nice time to be in Florida, but we made it back and kind of getting started again at the new year here. Not much to report in, on the work front, just because shipped some features in late December and we're gearing up for some new stuff now. One thing that I just wanted to throw out, unrelated to startups, except for that it is a startup, is the thing that I've discovered in the past like 10 days that has just been life-changing is Instacart. Do you have it where you live?
I don't know. I've never used it. I've heard of it before.
I hadn't either. Yeah. And I was always, you know, I don't particularly like grocery shopping. It always takes time. And especially I have to try to do it with two or three kids tagging along. And we've already, you know, the fact that we live in a major city now in Minneapolis, but really enjoyed like having Bite Squad around where I can order food and it's delivered. But Instacart is, it's a grocery shopping app and it's just well implemented, super easy to use, one to two hour delivery windows, depending on the time of day and how busy it is. And I mean, I can do like my entire, what would normally be, let's say a 75 to 90 minute drive. And in the snow, you know, it's like super cold. You don't want to get out of your car because it's 4 degrees and you're lugging a kid with you. And I can do it from my computer in 10 minutes. Like it's just freaking game changing. So I'm pretty stoked on it now. And I've only had maybe two or three deliveries so far, but I'm having a tough time seeing going back to doing it the old way. It's not expensive either. Like Wishly did this subscription where it's $150 for the entire year, and then you just get unlimited. You don't pay any delivery fees.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it's a trip. So if it comes to a place near you, and I don't just look at it as a convenience, right? It's a time thing. Like to save that time, you know, once, maybe twice a week, depending on how we eat a lot of fresh food. So I can't just shop 2 weeks out. Like when I was in college and I bought all macaroni, cheese, and ramen, you'd shop for like 3 months at a time and it wouldn't go bad. But you know, the fresh stuff, I literally went up at the grocery store at least once a week and sometimes twice. And this way, like I just sent an order through for all fresh fruit and berries and bananas and all that stuff. And it'll be here in the next, you know, 120 minutes.
Oh, really? So it's like you order it and then it's there in like 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. You can either select, well, you can select a time window, you know, what you could select a 1 hour time window later in the evening or tomorrow or whatever. Or sometimes if it's not, depending on how busy it is. And of course, middle of the day on, what is it, Thursday? There's just, the 2 hours. Yeah. It'll literally be here within 2 hours of when I clicked buy now.
Wow. That's interesting. We've talked about this a little bit, I think, but I used to work at Wegmans Food Markets and we implemented a system like this back in 2000.
Yep.
And
you had talked about it.
Yeah. The difference though, was that you could drive to the store and pick it up. So like you put everything in your car, your shop, and then you specify like, oh, I'm going to come pick it up at such and such time. And you had these like 10 or 15 minute time slots. You could just pick one and you just show up and they'd have everything ready for you. You just show up at the designated time and they'd ask your name and that was the end of it. Like they'd load up your car. You didn't even have to get out of your car.
Yep.
So that was, it's a little different though. This is also different than, what was it?
Webvan? Peapod. Yeah. It just tanked horrendously. But
Peapod is newer. It was Webvan that went out of business, like, you know, back in the day.
But Peapod did then too. And then I think someone bought the brand and they revitalized it because both of them raised a lot of money around 99, 2000.
Yeah.
But they were trying to warehouse everything.
Yep.
They were trying to be like Amazon, you know, or like a big grocery store distributor, whereas Instacart is more like Uber, you know, where they don't own anything.
Yeah.
And then get drivers to go, you know, shop and then put stuff in the cart and bring it by. And so, yeah, they just knock on the door, hand me a few bags, and it's like, thank you.
It's much more like a localized services business, like
yep.
running the errands for you, although the errand is very specific.
Right.
Product and so far,
I know that's what it is. I mean, so far, you know, one of the concerns obviously would be like, well, are they going to pick good produce? And are they going to pick good, if you order salmon, are they going to pick the crappy salmon? And so far, I haven't had any issues with that. I mean, you can tell that they have some type of onboarding to like teach people to get the good stuff. And if I'm sure if you rate them poorly, like, yeah, the fruit was bad, then, you know, there'll be some issues there. I think that's another difference is back in the day. I don't know how much recourse you would have had with someone sending you bad fruit.
Yeah, that would have been a little difficult. Like the way Wegmans did it was like they would actually have the butcher over at the butcher shop, like pick out the meats and stuff for you. So you knew that the people who were doing it were pretty experienced at what they did. So,
right. Cool. Well, let's transition into the episode here. We have several listener questions we're going to talk about today. And of course, per usual, voicemails go to the top of the stack. So let's kick off our first question. It's about being pre-product market fit.
Hi, my name is Evaldas, and I'm a co-founder of Stacktome, or easier pronounced Stacktome, a SaaS product for e-commerce retention advertisement. We are pre-product market fit and looking for ways to get more beta customers. I have a couple of questions. When it comes to driving traffic to the site, I was wondering if you have seen in a while educational videos instead of text content on sites like YouTube being successful. As I find that most SaaS websites have traffic coming from search, mostly through content. For some content I find useful, I can't find alternative good videos explaining the marketing concepts. Also, what would you recommend for finding getting into mastermind groups with other SaaS founders or marketers that would be post-product market fit a little bit ahead? Thanks for your always honest feedback and sharing your knowledge. I'm always learning something new each time I listen. Cheers.
So I guess to recap, and Rob, correct me if I'm wrong in my understanding of this, but the two questions that he had were essentially, how should you approach developing content for the website to drive traffic? Should you focus on video or should you focus on text in order to gain more attention when you're pre-product market fit? And then the second one is, how do you find people to join a mastermind group with? Is that right?
Yep, that's right. And to be clear about the video versus text, he wasn't asking about conversion. He was asking about trying to drive traffic. Like, will it rank? I think it's, will it rank better in search engines, basically?
Yeah. I mean, my understanding is that Google is still ranking video higher than text. But one thing you have to be a little bit careful of is to make sure that you're providing some sort of a transcript for it. And that helps Google to index the videos, because otherwise it has no way to know what is the actual content of the video. What are they saying? So there are ways to provide that information to Google's crawlers so that it will show up in the searches. That's one thing I would definitely do. The other thing that does come to mind, though, is that if you're pre-product market fit, I would actually do outbound stuff, and I would try to find and identify people who you think would be good customers and go after them, as opposed to trying to attract them and get them to come to you. Because really, that's the situation that you want to, I guess, double down on once you know who your ideal customer is. But if you're not at that point yet, you have to do some outreach. Otherwise, you're kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, that'd be my sentiment as well. I think you can mess around with the video versus the text thing. I have heard success stories of video working better because it's not something that everyone does, but you have to get into like video, like what, there's like video sitemaps. As you said, you want transcripts. May just be better. I don't even know if you want to host it on your site at that point. You may just want to have it on YouTube, because YouTube videos rank really well in Google, obviously, because Google, you know, prefers them over other things. So there's a whole specialty of learning video SEO and how to rank using video. And I would agree with you, Mike. I just don't think that's necessarily worth diving down that rabbit hole yet, because I bet you could kill a month just learning about it and probably 2 to 3 months experimenting with it. And I think there are more valuable things that you could be doing right now, even like outbound stuff, like you were saying. I could see running paid acquisition if you have any budget at all, because you want that instant, you want instant feedback, right? You want instant customers or not. You know, customers or rejections, as they say. Whereas this video SEO stuff, you're building for the 3, 6, 9, 12 month time frame, and you want to get to revenue faster than that, and you want to get to product market fit faster than that. So I would be scratching and clawing to get anyone using the app, and I just think of SEO and these types of strategies there as just such a longer term play. Not a bad thing to do, but if you're limited on time and budget, which I'm guessing you are, I wouldn't be focusing on this.
Yeah, I mean, that most of what you just said is about the iteration cycle and being able to adjust quickly versus taking that long-term approach, which is valid later on. But right now, it sounds like that's not the way to go.
Yep. And then for his second question, it was how to find a mastermind group. And our very own Ken Wallace with mastermindjam.com is kind of our go-to recommendation for folks looking to get matched up with fellow masterminders, both in the SaaS space, and there are e-commerce entrepreneurs, there's info marketers, there's all kinds of stuff. So if you go to the site and you submit your name and your time zone and a bit about yourself, I'm sure you categorize yourself in some way, like, you know, SaaS or info or whatever, and then you get matched up. And Ken has written an algorithm, and he also does a lot of manual stuff with it as well. And there's a small fee to getting matched up, but in my opinion, well worth the effort. And there's been a lot of successful groups that have formed out of using Ken's service.
So what's next?
Next question is our second and final voicemail of the episode, and then we'll get to some emails that came in. And this one is a question about the moral imperative of business.
Hi, Mike and Rob. This is Daniel calling in from Tualatin, Oregon. Love your podcast. Thanks for all the time that you put into it. Keep it up. Definitely in the wannapreneur category. I've tried a couple products myself. Haven't really seen success. And for me, the challenge is golden handcuffs. Consulting business is too good to really make the dive deep into product. But the question I have for you guys today is around the moral obligation of business. Interested to hear your perspective on income equality, social inequality, and, you know, kind of the bootstrap startup vision is build a business in potentially a hyper-competitive space that eventually throws off a bunch of cash. What do you feel is your moral obligation to reinvest that cash back into communities, you know, people around you, local geographic vicinity, and help address the, you know, growing problem of income equality? Thanks so much. Bye.
So I think for this question, I mean, when you're talking about bootstrap startups, there's actually two answers to this question, not just one. There's an answer that is applicable before you get to the point where your business is making a fair amount of money and throwing off excess capital. And then there's a second answer, which is after that point. The first one is, I would say that before you get to the point where the business is throwing off that extra money that you can deploy as you see fit to do whatever, above and beyond paying all the business expenses and paying yourself, you know, a reasonable salary, and potentially giving you extra money to be able to put away the additional profit from the business at that point, like you don't have any of that. Like before you get to the point where that has happened, you're not in a position to really do anything. And I don't feel like it's fair to put yourself in a mental state of mind where you feel obligated to do things for other people. I mean, your real focus should be getting the business to that point. And until you do, there's really not a lot else you can do. I think that if you try to put other people before you, you're just going to run into a problem where everyone is always going to be coming before you. So you're never going to pay yourself. There's entire books that are written about this where, you know, you really need to, I think there's one called Pay Yourself First or something along those lines, or that's a phrase that goes with it. But until you're there, it is not really justifiable, in my opinion, to attempt to do those things. Now, there's a difference between spending a little bit of time helping people here and there, but to make that your main focus is definitely not a route you should go down. Once you're after that point, then the situation, I think, changes pretty dramatically. And I think that I wouldn't say that there's a moral imperative, but depending on your own personal judgments and your own personal beliefs, I do feel like it is worthwhile going down that route, because there's actually a lot of benefits for you to, I don't want to say share the wealth or anything, but like help other people, because at one point you were where they were at. And I mean, we could probably talk at great length about this, but I mean, that's the type of people you run into at MicroConf as well. And I think that Rob, would you probably agree with me on most of that stuff in terms of being able to help other people and the additional benefits that you get from it. It's not really just about the money at certain point. Like if, as long as your business is providing for you, then you can kind of do whatever you want with the money afterwards, especially if you're already putting money aside to save. But it feels great to be able to help other people who are further behind you than, because you were there at one point as well.
Yeah, I think part of this is a somewhat personal choice, and I think part of it is, you know, how you view being part of a society in general, or a community, maybe a better way to say it. And I like the way you framed it, Mike. It's like it doesn't necessarily, like, you can help people without going and volunteering, you know, at the local soup kitchen, or without, you know, volunteering to train people how to learn computers in your local area. Like, you can help people by educating them on how to start startups. You can start a podcast and give content away for free that helps build this community of bootstrap founders. And it helps raise, like, kind of all of our standard of living, all of our quality of life, and it helps create jobs and all that stuff. And so it doesn't necessarily have to come in the form that I think a lot of people think about, but I have always been as generous as I possibly can with my money and with my time. And so since I was in college, I've given money to charities even when I didn't have much money. And as I've started making more money, I still, you know, give quite a bit of money away each year. I have always spent a lot of my time helping, whether it's having lunch with an entrepreneur, whether it's you and I doing the podcast for free for years, you know, whether it's blogging and giving away knowledge. And yes, there are outlets, you know, obviously I wrote a book and I sold that for $20 a copy, and you and I do host a conference, but the amount of time that we have essentially given to this community far, far, far outweighs the monetary, you know, the per hour cost or whatever that we would make, you know, the wage we would make on given all the time we've given away, it would not be a wise business decision to do that. And so we have done some of it because it's fun for us, and some of it because I think you, you know, agree with me. Like, I truly do enjoy giving back and helping people, and the emails that we both get, you know, where it's like, boy, you know, you're something you did, whether it was the, whether it was Founder Cafe or MicroConf or the podcast, like, it has changed my life and here's how. Like, I've received dozens of those emails, and those are the things, those have a lot of impact on me, you know, a lot of mental impact. So all that to say, I don't know that I would preach that everyone has to adopt this point of view, but my point of view is that you know, I always want to be able to give back. I have invested in a company in Fresno called Bitwise Industries that is it's a for-profit, but it is educating, it's educated thousands of folks in the local Fresno community, which is you know, has a real wealth disparity. And there's a big digital divide there, and they've educated thousands of people on how to program and how to use computers. And I wound up hiring, you know, Derek and I, well, I hired Derek out of Fresno, although there wasn't the digital divide with him. But then we hired three more people, created a bunch of tech jobs. Bitwise itself is, I don't even know how many people it is now, 50, 60 people. So there's good to be had. And I like to think about, there's good to be had in a way that everyone wins. I think that's how I think about it, is like, I so much enjoy more funding a company like Bitwise or doing what we do with MicroConf and Founder Cafe and this podcast, because I feel like it's a win-win. We're not just taking money that we earn as entrepreneurs and giving it to somebody. We're actually starting a sustainable business, you know, and that's why we've always wanted to make sure that MicroConf was sustainable. It's why we brought Xander on so that we could do it year after year. And it's why we've really streamlined the podcast production, because we want to be able to continue doing it even when we have other things going on. And so I think turning it in again, I think like an entrepreneur, right? It's like a person who turns systems into profit in essence. And I want some of that profit to give back to whatever community it is, whether it's the bootstrap startup community, whether it's the community I live in. But I also, you know, want, I guess I, it needs to be a win for me as well in a small way. And it doesn't mean, oh, we need to get rich off it. But I do think that making it into something sustainable is how that's how I've always thought about it. And then, as you said, I really like what you said about the kind of pre-sustainable business. Because when I was scratching and clawing and I was freaked out about money and I was, you know, just trying to get whatever it was, Hittail revamped or the real tough financial year I had with Drip, I couldn't even think about, you know, any type of moral imperative of helping other people, because I was just trying to take care of me and my family. But once I got past that point, then yes, my mind is freed up and I absolutely give very generously to a lot of, you know, a lot of things, whether it's charities or these sustainable businesses that hopefully are doing some good in the world. So thanks for the question, Daniel. I hope that was helpful to hear our thoughts on it. Our next question is from Stefan Dubois from surveyanyplace.com. He says, "Hey, Mike and Rob, I listened to your podcast for several years now, not since the beginning, but close to it. I really love it because it has so much actionable stuff. On one of the latest episodes, you guys talked about content marketing at the end of the episode, and I remember Rob saying he would not advise for startups to make it their number one tactic, for example, creating a blog and publishing content. But he would recommend doing something else like joint venturing with players in your field that already have an audience. I assume he's referring to guest blogging, joint webinars, etc." I'm going to step out real quick. Two of those, guest blogging and joint webinars, correct, as well as integration marketing, which I've talked about in the past, which is where you integrate and then you both co-promote. All right, so back to his email. "It would be great to dig a bit deeper into this topic, such as how exactly would you recommend doing this? If you had to start Drip or another SaaS company right now, how would you apply this given all your learnings? Thanks for your help. Keep up the great work. Stefan."
So I think one key point to keep in mind is that, you know, as part of his question, he said, if you had to start Drip or another SaaS company right now, how would you apply this given your learnings? There's a point at which doing this kind of stuff is too early. Like, you're not far enough along where it makes sense to go down that road, mainly because it's not going to make sense for whoever it is that you approach to do a joint webinar or guest blogs. With guest blogging, you can certainly write articles, and as long as they are relevant to the audience of the person that you are guest blogging on on their site and they are receptive to that kind of thing, then sure, you can totally do that. But when it comes to something like a joint webinar, you really can't do that unless you have something that is tangible and of benefit that is going to be given to that person's audience, whoever it happens to be. The other thing is, what are you offering the owner of that audience? Like, what are they getting out of it? Is it really just educating their people? Are you promoting your product, or is it just like an educational thing where you're explaining how to do something or about a particular topic or a technique or something along those lines? But again, like, none of this stuff you can do until after you're at a point where you have a product that is functional and you have people who are onboarded and paying, and you kind of know what your ideal audience looks like. Because otherwise, you're approaching people that their audience may not necessarily overlap with yours. So those are the things that I would keep in mind when trying to go down this road. Is like, until you're at that point, none of that stuff applies. You're just not going to go anywhere.
Right. And the thing to keep in mind is, this is where it's nice to have a nice little email list, because if you are going to do, I'm going to say, mostly stick to joint webinars and integration marketing. If you're going to do that and you have a list of 10, 20, 30,000 people, for the most part, you're going to be able to say, look, let's do a joint webinar. You email your list, I email mine, or you do vice versa, right? Where you give a webinar to their audience and they give it to you, and you can just trade straight across. You don't have to mess with affiliate commissions. You just get the benefit of the traffic, and so do they. And the same thing with integration marketing. The bigger the list you have, the better off you are in the, you know, kind of getting people interested in doing some type of joint promotion with you. If you have 300 people on an email list, it is much, much less likely that someone's going to want to do a joint promotion with you. With that said, in the early days, before you can build up that list, you're going to want to use affiliate commissions. And so if you do approach someone to do a joint webinar or to do integration marketing, you can say, look, you know, we pay 20, 30% affiliate commission, and here's the link. And that's how you're going to get them interested, because then at that point, they can at least count on some type of revenue stream. So the way I did it back with Hittail, which is what, 2012, 2013, is I looked around in the space and I looked at complementary products. And so Hittail was a long tail SEO keyword tool. And I looked at like rank trackers and other keyword tools that didn't use the same approach that we did. And I, at the time, just cold emailed a bunch of them. And I remember I made this list of like 7 or 8 SaaS apps and that weren't these big behemoths. You know, I didn't email SEO Moz or anything, but it was kind of ones that appeared to be, you know, more startup-y or bootstrapped or whatever. And all of them wrote back and said they wanted to do it. And I was overwhelmed by that. I expected to get like one out of that. And I wasn't able to do JVs with all of them. I think we were even just doing JV mailings. We were just going to email each other's list and kind of recommend the tool. I, of course, tried out any tool, you know, I recommended. And then they did the same thing. And we did the non, since our lists were about the same size, we did no affiliate commission at the time. I'm not saying that's going to work in every niche, but that is something I did. Then with Drip, when we started doing JV webinars, it was much more about relationships, because that was in my wheelhouse, right? And it was, I mean, I just emailed people who I knew in the MicroConf space, you know, in the kind of in our community. And so pretty sure, let's say we did joint webinar, I'm pretty sure with Brennan Dunn. I know we did one with Ruben from BidSketch. There were several others, but that was a lot easier. So it depends on if you have a network in the space or if you're going cold, but I've made either one work, and it is something that you can do. And then in terms of integrations, you start to build the integration and then you create a nice landing page for it and you email the company and you say, hey, can we do co-promotion? And with that, it really is going to depend on the size, because Basecamp and Stripe are not going to co-promote with you. You'll get lucky to even get listed in their directory at this point. But if you get someone who, it doesn't have to be a tiny little company, if you get a hold of someone in marketing at, you know, even a decent sized startup, they will at least have the question of, well, how big's your list? And if you say you have 20 or 30,000 people on an email list, it can raise an eyebrow. You know, it can get you a mention. Maybe it's just a single mention in an email newsletter they send out, but they might have 100,000 subscribers and it can get some traffic driven to you. So that's how I would think about doing it these days.
As a general rule, when you're trying to find people to do these sorts of co-marketing efforts with, try not to go after somebody who has a list that's more than twice your size or less than half yours. So if you stick within that range, whatever that size happens to be, you're probably going to have much better results, because if somebody is much larger than you, they're not going to want to do a joint marketing campaign with you unless you know who they are and you've have a developed relationship with them. And if they're less than half your size, then it's probably not going to do a lot for you. So that's the thing that I would keep in mind as well when you're trying to find people.
Yep, that's a good point. Our last question for today is from Rusty Shackelford, and he says, can you give me some insight on when to provide a trial versus a demo for apps that rely heavily on user-provided data? I'm developing a medical records SaaS, and I'm keenly aware that it's a waste of time for a prospective client to do a trial of my product when they would need to enter so much of their own data, most likely in addition to entering that data into whatever product they're currently using. Would you suggest providing demos where I lead them through examples versus a trial of my product?
I think in this particular case, if you're dealing with medical records and you have the objection or hurdle that somebody needs to overcome to start using your app is that they need to provide the data, I would lean much more heavily on the demos than on trials. I'd push them directly towards a demo, whether that's, you know, signing up directly on the website or getting them onto an email list and then sending them to a sign up form where they can sign up for a demo, maybe ask them for information for through a survey or something along those lines, push them through that way. I would not go the trial route. If you go with the demo route, what you can do is then you can directly address that particular problem during the demo itself and say, hey, you know, we understand that in order to get you set up, this is what you need to do. The next step after this is to decide if you want to move forward with the product or not and move to a trial. And if so, send us this data and we'll put it in for you. So essentially, you're doing onboarding for them and you eliminate that objection up front. You can try pushing that off to them, and which is really what you're doing if you send them to a trial without you interacting with them, which is going to raise that as an objection. And they're going to say, well, I don't really want to do this, versus if they have other things going on, like they're just not going to do it is really what the bottom line is, especially if they have to change it, whatever their current processes are, versus if you talk to them, you have that conversation, get them to buy into the concept and what they can get out of the product after they start using it. If they buy into that story, they send you the data. So you take care of that legwork for them. And then once that data is in place inside of their app, then it's ready for them to use. And they don't have to do all of that extra work. And, you know, it just makes it easier for them to overcome that hurdle. Because if you don't have like a good import mechanism or good ways to just pipe the data out of other apps, it's going to make it really challenging to get people to go from a trial to a paid conversion, because they're just not going to do the work is really the bottom line.
Yep. In general, I lean towards demos over trials. The problem is it doesn't scale very well. And so as you scale up, that's why you resort to having a trial. But relying on the customer themselves to orient and find their way around inside your app enough to understand the value, whereas you can explain that value in you know, a 10, 15 minute demo. I mean, I bet in like the first 5 minutes of your demo, you can give more value than someone poking around inside your trial. So aside from the fact that your app sounds not complex, but there's a lot of kind of onboarding necessary, a lot of work on their part, there's no way I would consider letting people in for a free trial.
For some of the medical records, I mean, there's subtle questions that people are going to have, which revolve around trust issues, which you're not going to be able to really overcome very well with that, with a free trial.
Right. And then they're going to have this account with no data in it. And so it's going to look terrible. And you're going to have an account full of data that you can demo them. So it's going to, you're going to show exactly the, you know, the value that they'll receive. So yeah, in your instance in particular, I definitely do demos in general. I mean, when you're bootstrapping and starting up, like all during customer development, I recommend doing demos because you get so much more information from them. If you're still pre-product market fit, I recommend doing demos because you're going to find out why people, you know, do or don't sign up. And then they're going to be more likely to get in touch with you if they decide to cancel or not get onboarded, because you already have a relationship with them. Post product market fit, if you can still do it. I mean, I know at a certain point it makes sense to go with self-service trial sign up, but the dirty little secret is, as much as I don't like demos, I'd prefer to get in and dig around with an app and try it out. Most people want a demo. They would much prefer someone to walk them through an app rather than try to poke around and do it themselves. And we had done a few experiments where we had just trials versus funneling people into demos, and we converted the demos to into paid accounts. It was like 2x the rate of just letting people get onboarded themselves, even with all the help that we were giving them via email and in app. So you're going to convert more, people are going to get more value out of it. And in general, I think it's just a better way to go. There are obviously exceptions to this. There are tools like, let's say, I'm trying to think of it, like even like Hittail, which just, it was a high volume, higher churn tool. It was an SEO keyword tool, and people would come in and try it out here and there. And it was super easy. At the end, it was like a one-click setup. You literally just OAuthed into something, and then it would pull you know, keywords out. So, I mean, a demo would be interesting, but only for high value accounts, because some of those accounts are paying $10 a month. And at that point, it just doesn't make sense to do demos. So there are exceptions to this, but as a rule, I would go demo as the default and then figure out, well, is this one of those exceptions where I should really just have self-service trial available? Or do you have both options? You know, that's what Drip has today. You can still sign up for trial if you want to poke around, but there's a big push, of course, to get people into demos because of all the reasons that I've stated here.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@starvestherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit starvestherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.